Okay, let me get this out of the way right away. Vancouver-St. Louis is already my favorite series. Welcome to Hockey Central. Jeff Merrick alongside Brian Brick and Justin Bourne, Elliot Friedman from 31 Thoughts, Hockey Night in Canada, NHL on Sportsnet, amongst other titles. We'll be aboard here in about 4 or 5 minutes' time. Bourne, Berkey, good afternoon. Want to get into a lot of the games we saw last night, a little preview of what we're going to see this afternoon and this evening. But we're going to spend some time this afternoon early here with Elliot talking about the fallout from what we had yesterday on the program, which is the press conference with not just the Maple Leafs players, but also management, Kyle Dubas, Sheldon Keefe, and team president Brendan Shanahan. Berkey, you were on the station earlier making the point that the apologies didn't go far enough. The apologies didn't bleed, in your estimation, into action. Can you restate that for this audience, please?
Yeah, so I thought when you do a year-end press conference after an unsatisfactory year, and believe me, I have plenty of practice doing this, folks. I'm an expert. There's three messages. One is, it's not good enough. We're not happy with the year. We're sorry. We let you down. And they said both of those things, in my mind, well enough. But the next thing was, we believe in the group, and we're going to stick with the process. And I'm like, okay, I'm a season ticket holder. That's just not a good message for me. I don't think this is working. Your defense isn't good enough. You got no bite. You got to stop using the analytics and puck possession and telling me everything's going to be okay. Let's get some angry people on the ice, get some ugly, grumpy people. And I was blown away that they didn't say, this is what we need to fix, because that's what we always try to do. So this is where we fell short, and we'll try to fix it.
Bourne, your thoughts after we've had 24 hours to digest it now?
I'm stuck on, sort of the demeanor of how it was kind of carried out. And I just felt like from Dubas, there was a lot of, defiance and almost, almost an angry amount of, pushback to what people say about his team. But it came off to me as a sort of a lack of empathy for the fans and the way it's going. It didn't come off particularly well in that regard. And I also thought that some of the more minor things, like trying to make points like about CC and analytics or about, their depth scoring numbers compared to the other top teams. It's like, that wasn't the time or place for those defenses, which may be very valid defenses. It felt like a big picture time to talk about the state of affairs and where things are going, and those defenses can be made in a million other smaller interviews. It just didn't feel like the right time and it almost came off defensive to me.
Berkey, I know you like the military analogy, so I'll couch this by an old statement from Winston Churchill, talking about the Russian Revolution during World War I and the problems associated with it. His point was, for the Russian people, her ship went down within sight of port. Her ship went down within sight of port. When you're the general manager, as you well know, of Toronto, and your ship goes down, it is always within sight of port. Nothing gets missed. How much does this compound this issue in Toronto?
Oh, I talked about that a little bit this morning on the fan. I think people should understand my view of the media. Now, this I don't expect the media to agree or any listeners to agree. But what compounds the problem in Toronto is the size of the media, is the mass of people you're dealing with. So people, if you ever look at a TV shot of a dressing room, the dressing room is big for the media. The players don't need that much room. We'd actually like a smaller room. There's a rink in Cologne, Germany, where one wall is on wheels. And when the players are practicing and the media is not admitted, they've got those walls about 15 feet apart so players can look each other in the eye and talk to each other. And then they move it back to accommodate the media after practice. That's in Cologne. So to me, that's why the room is so big. So in Calgary, we'd have 30 people in the room after a game, maybe 35. And really good media there, not saying anything about the quality of the media there, they're fantastic. But there's 80 in the Leafs room after a game. And so when you lose, they all pick up a rock. It's the size of the group that you have to deal with. So when you're not successful, the volume of negative energy that comes toward you and negative commentary is massive. And so we'd lose a game 10 people would throw a rock at Dion, 10 at Phil, 10 at me, 10 at Ron Wilson, whatever. So it's overwhelming, the volume of it. It's not that the media here are any harder than they are in any other market. So, but you're right. It's a combination of that. So you start with the size of it, then social media triples it, quadruples it. And then this is one of the most well-known brands on the planet and a beloved team. And so people want answers, and it's a difficult part. I've had to do that press conference. I felt for those guys yesterday because I've had to do it where we've missed the playoffs, and I've had to face the media and explain. But the one thing lacking, and I agree with what Justin said to a point, that Kyle seemed defensive, but I think you kind of have to be. I think he was going to bat for certain guys. But there was no action plan for me. It's like, okay, we know we need to upgrade our D. We need to get some bite, and here's what we're going to do. And I didn't hear any of that, and it was very frustrating for me.
Let's get Elliot Friedman aboard. Justin, more of your thoughts here in a couple of moments. Joining us from 31 Thoughts, Hockey Night, and the NHL on Sportsnet is Elliot Friedman. Elliot, we're just talking about the fallout now, 24 hours later, from the Dubas, Shanahan, and Keefe press conference. Now that we've had a full day to digest it and think about it, talk about it, write about it, any conclusions that you drew from yesterday?
Yeah, I mean, like, nothing this guy said yesterday really surprised me, Jeff. Like, it was pretty much what I expected in terms of, you know, both the questions that were asked and the answers that were given. You know, I think this is, you know, I think that one of the things that, from my point of view, from the answers from, you know, Shanahan and Dubas and Keith, I think they were really trying not to create any crazy headlines. Or I look at it that way. I think they know how the market feels about the team. I think they know that people are really frustrated. If you read the players' quotes or listened to what they said, you know, they recognized that things had to change. I saw that purely as the exact opposite of a Brian Burke media conference. Do not throw gasoline on the fire.
I would never do that. I didn't think of it that way, Elliot, but I seldom think of things as you do. I think there's some accuracy.
That's why you've been so successful, yes.
There's some accuracy to what you said, very little, but some. I think what's missing is really like the it's maddening. As a season ticket holder, it's maddening to me to watch and watch the team lose the way it did, and then have the GM say, we believe in our players, we believe in our system. And what they're doing is putting together nice regular season teams.
Mm-hmm. You know, Berkey, like to me, talk is cheap, right? And you know this because you worked on that side of the business, particularly in Canada. And I just think that I've been in this business long enough to know that what you say publicly and what you say privately can be two very different things. And I saw that yesterday as from the, at least the management and the coach was, we know how everybody here feels. Let's not make it worse. But that doesn't mean that's what's going to happen. And, you know, I think that they know that if they don't get better next year, that, you know, the changes could go into the front office. And that's why I think that they will look. Now, will they hugely change the makeup of the team? Maybe not. But I think they're going to look at some things. Like I think they're going to put some names out there. They're going to test the market value on them. They're going to see what they can get, and they'll make their decisions based on that. And I wouldn't be surprised if you see a couple more guys like in the Kyle Clifford style that show up here as well, probably on the blue line.
Elliot, you're as familiar with anyone with the concept of getting radioed, which I believe you can explain as basically talking for 20 minutes and then someone kind of cribs a sentence and people blow up about the sentence that's wildly out of context. Recently, you guys just put out 31 Thoughts podcast, I think today or yesterday.
Yep. Last night.
Yeah, and the quotes I'm seeing today are, you know, here's Friedman saying Mitch Marner's name is out there, was out there after the season. And I know that's not necessarily what you said. So what is the, maybe you could explain to us, you know, is the Mitch Marner situation. Kyle was very defensive about him. The team loves him. There's a lot around his name. Maybe you could just further the conversation you had about Mitch Marner for us on Hockey Central.
Sure. I think that, you know, like the whole radio thing, Justin, it's a pain in the butt, but it's kind of like life in the big city now. You kind of have to be prepared for it. So this is what I think. Like, I heard on Monday after they lost, just, you know, you're making your calls, you're texting, what do you hear out there? And I had a couple guys say to me, hearing anything on Marner? And, you know, they'd said they heard his name. I believe what Dubas said yesterday. I believe that Kyle Dubas does not want to trade Mitch Marner. I'm as sure as I can be that he's not going to trade Mitch Marner. I think that, the one thing I've learned about Marner over the years, Justin, and I did say this in the podcast and write it, is that the things that get said about him and the way the organization feels about him are not 100% the same thing. I just think that Marner's got some paranoia around him, not him, and it kind of gets out, and people think that, they hear that and they hear, the Leafs don't respect Marner enough and they don't think about him that highly. I don't believe that. I think they do think very highly of him. That I've written it and said it now about five times. Like, that King Clancy thing, that was big to the Leafs. And what I'm talking about there is Marner's nomination for the King Clancy Trophy. And I think Kyle mentioned it yesterday. You know, this was a year where we had a really tough negotiation. It wasn't easy on anyone. And still, he was by far the most charitable guy on the team. And he almost always says yes when he's asked. And people notice those things. And you get the benefit of the doubt when you're that kind of a person. And so I think that because of some of the craziness that kind of gets said around Marner, people were thinking, he might be dealt. Looking into it, Justin, I don't believe it. I'd be surprised if he was traded. I think they think he's going to be an Art Ross Trophy candidate for years to come. And I think they think he cares and he's a big part of their group. So, like I said, I heard some rumors, but after looking into them, I didn't really believe them.
Elliot, I can't see, and I know many Maple Leafs fans won't want to hear this, I can't see a Whopper in the works with the Toronto Maple Leafs. I can't see the Marner. I can't see the Nylander. I can't see any of these huge deals. I think that...
Like, what's a huge deal?
Well, Nylander would be a huge deal. Marner would be a huge deal. Morgan Riley would be a huge deal. Like, one of these types of players.
I'd be surprised at Riley, too.
I'd
be shocked.
I don't think... And here's why. I think that Kyle Dubas is very much of the belief that everyone on this team has a spot on a hockey team. Thelonious Monk used to always say, a piano ain't got no wrong keys. I think there's a spot on this, just much like Phil Kessel. There was a spot for Phil Kessel. There is a spot for Phil Kessel on every team. There's not a spot for five Phil Kessels, but there's a spot for a Phil Kessel, much like there is a spot for a Willie Nylander, a Mitch Marner, an Austin Matthews, a Morgan Riley. I think that he's very much of the belief that what we need to do is put different pieces around these players. That's the issue. The issue is not these players. It's what we have around them. Agree or disagree?
I think some of that is true. I think a lot of that is true. The one thing, though, is that if, you know, sometimes to get quality, you have to give up quality. Or, you know, say you there's a piece that you really like that you can get and it doesn't fit in the cap, but you decide you want that piece. And then you have to do something else. Like I said, Jeff, like, they've got time. And I think what they're going to do is I think they're going to put several different names out there. I mean, like, we talk about this a lot now. How many really untradeable players are there in this league?
How many untradeable?
Yeah, like, how many guys in this league are untouchable? 10?
Probably about 15 guys, I would say.
Okay.
And some of those are you're not going to let them go because you don't want to lose from your franchise, and some are just unmovable because of their contracts.
Right. Well, I don't believe a ton in unmovable because of their contracts. We've seen a lot of guys. Now, this time on Earth is going to challenge that. But yeah. Generally, Jeff, we've seen a lot of contracts that people were thought unmovable got moved. I say untouchable from the point of view as these guys are not getting traded. So let's say there's 10 to 15 guys in the NHL. That means the rest of them, their names get discussed. Now, that doesn't mean it's going to happen, but that means, you know, you talk about it with another GM. You say, hey, if I did this, what would you say to me? And I think that's what's going to happen. I think Dubas is going to go out there and he's going to put some names out there and he's going to say, it doesn't mean they're getting traded, but it does mean he's going to learn what the market value is for them.
Hmm.
And, you know, like, and I think he's going to do that with several guys.
Berkey, give us a peek behind the curtain here, what Elliot is talking about. As a general manager, how often would you talk about all of your players with other GMs? I remember Kelly Rudy told me once he was shocked talking to Rogge Vachon when he was the GM of Los Angeles, when Rogge told him, oh, yeah, I talk about all of our guys all day long. This is my job as a GM.
Well, first off, what happens is you start off as a GM and you say, I'm going to talk to every GM every week. So, you know, when I started, there were 21 GMs. So you make so many calls a day, you talk to everyone every week. Then you figure out there's probably, now you're up to 31 teams, there's probably 10 guys you just can't make deals with. Like, I could never make a deal with Darcy Reguerre. I finally traded Dominic Moore there, but years and years, I could not make a deal. He was speaking French, I was speaking Italian. We did not value our players the same way. And we just could, and I used to say to him, how come we're good friends? There's no personal issue. But we can't make a deal. I said, you just value your players too high. And he said, well, you value yours too high. So you figure out the guys that are duds and you talk to them about every 14 days. But your regular trading partners, guys, you sense you can make a deal with, you talk to, Elliot's right, you talk to at least once a week. And you don't float names because they leak. So this guy will turn to someone and say, what do you think of Elliot Friedman? And the guy will say, I really like him. Let's try to get him. Now two people know. And it leaks out. He calls his assistant GM or his chief scout and said, what do you think, Elliot Friedman? I like him. Well, let's try and get him. Now, so you don't float names of big players that you aren't serious about trading, and you swear the guy to secrecy. But Elliot's right. That's the way they'll float some names. I think they'll start with lesser names. And then the easiest guy, my favorite guy to deal with, the two guys that were right away like this, Paul Holmgren was like this all the time. Paul Holmgren would say, I'll trade these seven guys. I like these five guys on your team. Is there a fit? You could waste a half hour with another GM to get to those names. With Paul, it'd be the first 30 seconds. And the late, great Ron Caron was like that, too.
Hmm.
What was Doug Wilson like?
Doug Wilson, and he'll hear it. I said this, Doug Wilson is a slow player.
Yes, he is.
He's a slow player. It's a half-hour phone call, and then he's got the greatest deal in the world for you. It'll get you fired, but it's a great deal for you. He's okay, a very very shrewd guy.
Just as an aside, because he's now quoted as saying, it's clear to me we need to make changes. How is David Poile in Nashville to deal with?
He's very, very cautious. He goes. He's a slow player, and I've worked with him in two Olympics. He's slow to speak and express his opinions. Like, he's very cautious. I'd hate to play poker with him, but if you look at his record, he's made some of the biggest deals in the history of the National Hockey League. He's fearless.
Yeah, he's got big brass ones.
Yeah, don't let that mild-mannered appearance fool you. David Poile is a real player. He's got a gun under the table, and he's there to win.
Pull the trigger on a couple of those deals in this Nashville offseason. Sorry, we're getting sidetracked. Borny, go ahead. You're on with Freed again.
Elliot, have you seen any sort of evolution in Kyle Dubas from when he first joined the organization to the leader he is there now?
Well, I think, like, he's probably a lot more, you know, for lack of a better term, battle-hardened. You know, like, some of the guys who were listening to the Zoom calls yesterday were saying, and that they thought that he was a bit, like, short with his answers. He wasn't as friendly and accommodating as he normally can be. Like, I wouldn't, like, to me, I think that's probably a good thing. Like, you shouldn't be happy or accommodating or friendly after the way that this season ended. You know, like, every year that you're a general manager, the pressure ratchets up on you, right? And, unless you win the Stanley Cup, it goes away for a little while. But every year that you don't win, the pressure ratchets up. And I think that, you know, this is a big off season for him. I'm sure he feels it. There's no way he can't feel it. Now, the one thing, Justin, I have heard is that the Kyle Clifford move wasn't the only move along those lines that he considered. That, you know, he looked, now he knows Clifford. There's a personal history there, which I think made it a little bit easier for him. But I've had some people tell me in the past few days that he considered some other moves that would have surprised people. So I do wonder if this is the off season where we see him step a little further out of his comfort zone. And while I don't think he'll ever vary from the idea that he wants a certain way to win, I think what he is realizing and potentially prepared to accept is that you can still play that way, but there have to be some modifications. And I'm very, like, Jeff, I heard you talked about Gudas on the show and we talked about him on the podcast. Mm-hmm. It could be an interesting one.
That would be. And the one thing, I mentioned this on the pod that we just released, much like when Kyle Clifford, when that move was made, Kyle Dubas made sure that he mentioned the underlying numbers, the analytics support this decision. And I think the same thing could be said of Radko Gudas. Here's another name, and here's another potential move. For those that haven't heard it, haven't read your blog or heard the podcast yet, should Maple Leafs fans be surprised if at the start of next season, Joe Thornton is on the team?
Well, I think the biggest question is, can you do both of them? Like, if you have Spezza back, and it sure sounded to me yesterday that there's a mutual will to bring back Spezza, can you do both guys?
Can you?
Berkey, Justin, what do you think?
No.
No, I'm with Berkey on that one. But I love it in theory. I just can't see it in practice, it playing out well. But I was just actually thinking as you said that, like, I feel like a Thornton media fight would be inevitable at some point because he just says what he thinks. It would be inevitable.
Well, I think that what, like, why did they go out and get Ron Hainsey? Because Ron Hainsey is a give-no-bleeps kind of guy. And you need the guys like that. And, you know, Ron Hainsey and Joe Thornton are guys who've been around a long time. They've got really thick skins. They're their own guys. They don't care what anyone else thinks. It's like, you know, it's like dealing with your grandparents, right, when they finally decide they don't care what anyone else thinks anymore. And I think that Dubas really values that. I think they're interested. I've said this before, and someday maybe I may be right about this, but I'm just not sure you can do both Thornton and Spezza.
I think they should go after Sean Thornton.
And put him in the lineup?
Yes.
That's not a bad idea.
The truculent Maple Leafs return. Hey, listen, we heard... I'm going to turn this over to Berkey here in a sec. We heard a lot of defense of Cody Ceci yesterday by Kyle Dubas. Should we expect then Cody Ceci to return to the Maple Leafs?
I'd be surprised. I would be. I think they've got to change the mix on that side.
I don't disagree. We talked on the podcast that just came out about the goalie market. How do you see the blue line market?
Well, I think there's going to be a lot of, you know, look, I think if they don't want to do anything on the left side, they're totally set there. They've got Riley, they've got Muzzin, they got Dermott, they got Rescending. Now, so I think they're set there. Then you look at the right side, and you're kind of sitting there and you see a hole, right? Mm-hmm. You know, for lack of a better term or lack of a better name, Gudas is a right shot. But that's where I think the change is going to come. I would be surprised if CC's back next year.
Berkey, last word to you.
Yeah, I hate to agree with Elliot because I seldom do, but I think he's right. And I will say this. I don't know Cody Ceci well, but I think he's a really good guy, and I think he's a better player than he showed here. And I predict his next stop, he'll have more success. It's a hard market. They single out defensemen in this market. They got all over Dion. They ran Larry Murphy out of town. They hated Jake Gardner. And they're going to turn on Cody. I think it's time for him to find a new postal code.
Yeah, I think there's going to be, like, Jeff, like, I think this year it's a buyer's market. I think there's going to be a lot of players who are going to look at the landscape and they're going to say, I don't want to be the guy without the job. And maybe guys are willing, and I think specifically guys who are, like, who Warrior, if they're like a 5-7 guy on a team, they're going to take a deal. Maybe they'll go to Europe with an out, but they're going to take a deal because they're not going to want to risk that they can't find a space at the table. So I think if you're patient and you have opportunity, you're going to find some – you have the chance to find some gems. And I think that there will be players who look – who are right shot D who look at the Leafs defense and say, you know what, I could have a shot there on a team that's going to score a lot.
Elliot, before we let you go, one thought on this. I know it's only a one-game audit, but I can already tell my favorite series in this round of the Stanley Cup playoffs is going to be Vancouver and St. Louis. Agree or disagree?
Yeah, I agree. That was a great game last night. And it was, like, you know, the one thing I really am impressed with Vancouver is that their two best players, like, you know, Babcock used to freak at the way people talked about Datsyuk and Zetterberg before they became stars. He said that, you know, to him, true toughness was, can you take the abuse and play your game and be good? And he always said that Datsyuk and Zetterberg never got enough credit for it before they got everybody realized how good they were. Like, I look at Hughes and Pettersson, and I see that. I see two guys who recognize that you're going to be a target, and they just play. And it's a huge compliment, and I think it sets a great tone for that team. And, you know, I'll tell you, like, all their depth guys, they're playing really well. Sutter, their depth guys are giving them a lot.
It's true. And Tyler Myers, his streak of penalties continues for the Vancouver Canucks. The game doesn't start until Tyler Myers takes a minor. On that, we'll let you go. Freach, thanks as always. We'll check in regular.
All right, guys. Take care.
There he is, Elliot Friedman from 31 Thoughts, Hockey Night in Canada, and the NHL on Sportsnet. Quick break. We'll take a breath. We'll take a pause. We come back. We'll talk about Vancouver and the St. Louis Blues. That game last night, Vancouver drawing first blood with a 5-2 win. Also, talk about Montreal and Philadelphia and how Carey Price saved Nick Suzuki's life. That is next as Hockey Central continues on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Welcome back to the program. Jeff Merrick alongside Brian Burke and Justin Bourne. 5-2 is the final score. The Vancouver Canucks draw first blood. They now lead their best of seven series with the St. Louis Blues 1-0. Berkey, there was a lot to unpack in that game. JT Miller, St. Louis going after Vancouver physically. David Perron, Bo Horvat with a pair of goals. Elias Pettersson, excellent again. Ditto Quinn Hughes. What stood out for you as it came to and relates to the Vancouver-St. Louis Game 1 that we saw last night?
Well, I think JT Miller has been a really important addition to their lineup, and Jim Benning was criticized when he made that deal because it was a high price tag, and I think he's delivered big time. He scores goals, he wins faceoffs, he can kill penalties. But last night, St. Louis tries to beat you with long pants hockey, big boy hockey. And last night, Vancouver said, we can play that game too, even though it's not our first nature. It's not foreign to us. So I like to have the response. They were like, you hit us all you want, we're still going to play. I thought they were really good last night.
Borny?
You know what's so great about the young stars, you know, just from the conversation to pick it up from before the break about how Datsyuk and Zetterberg took a lot of abuse. Dude, with Pettersson and Hughes, Pettersson has some of the best edges in the NHL. Like, you can lean on him heavy, and that guy does not spend much time on the ice. It's pretty impressive. And with Hughes, I had someone use the comparison of Lamar Jackson in the NFL as a quarterback. Like, if you want to be physical on him and chase him around, it's the worst thing you can do. He just shucks and drives, and he's by. He's almost like a guy who's so shifty, you have to contain him, and you can't really just make the game plan to chase him around the rink. So those two guys, I thought, handled the attempts at physical play from the Blues pretty well last night.
I don't know if there's a defenseman in the NHL right now who creates as much ice around him as quickly as Quinn Hughes does. Berkey, can you think of anybody? I mean, you think of Quinn Hughes, and when he gets the zone, it's a couple of shoulder fakes, a couple of quick cuts, and all of a sudden he has a lot of room to make a play. I don't know anyone else in the league that does it as efficiently as Quinn Hughes.
I can't think of a defenseman. He reminds me a lot. Mitch Marner's really good at that. Yes. Mitch Marner's good at hitting the line with speed and then stopping up and continuing to drift towards the boards. And all of a sudden, he's got a square around him around 14 feet.
Right.
Now he's got space, and now he's bought time for his line mates to join him. I think it's a great gift, and Quinn Hughes has that. And if you start to cheat to the outside to take that away where he's going to stop up and drift, he'll cut right inside of you. So it's a gift. And it does those two things. It creates space. It gives him time to make a play. And it gives his line mates and teammates time to join him. It's very dangerous.
Borna, you pay attention to stuff like that. Anyone else come to mind when you look at what Quinn Hughes does with his blades and how he's able to make ice?
Well, you know who tries to play like that but doesn't do it as well is someone like Travis Dermott. Like, I just think of like fast twitch muscles and trying to throw out fakes, and as Berkey said, like, it's an unbelievable skill to have because it's so hard to execute. You know, yeah. One thing that did come to my mind last night, and Jeremy Rutherford was tweeting about this earlier, was just how much the Blues miss having their depth guys like Blaze, Barbashev, and Steen in a game like that where their fourth line is just not as good, and they look like a team who needs to be four lines solid to run that forecheck and make it hard on those skill guys at Vancouver. So I thought that was a notable absence for the Blues last night.
You know, and by the way, David Perron quickly becoming public enemy number one. When you talk about you can never go home again, Perron and St. Louis are proving you can go home again and again and again. I don't know what happened, Berkey, with David Perron, but ever since Vegas, it almost seems as if he's a different player, and he's become a target for the Vancouver Canucks.
I hate him.
That's a compliment, right?
Yeah, I'll tell you why I hate him. This guy has dogged me. Every time one of my teams played against David Perron, he'd score goals, he'd hit people. I hate him. I absolutely hate him. He was really good last night, and the thing is, he's a good goal scorer. Sorry, my printer just went on. I don't know why. That's what that noise you're hearing. And he's a fairly good-sized guy with a high skill set, and he doesn't mind when it gets rough. He'll hit back. Mm-hmm. He'll cheap shot you. But they can't change the way they play. For me, St. Louis has to stick with the long pants hockey. It's how they won. I don't think they're going to panic losing game one. I think their goaltending looked human. And I would have this guy on a short leash. He seems to lack that swagger he had last year. And I could see them having him on a short leash for game two, but I don't think they'll change the way they played. And they're not panicking. They just won a championship. They get it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to say, Borna, if you're the St. Louis Blues playing in that game last night, first of all, heck of a game. And you hope that we get seven like that. But if you're St. Louis, are you now saying, okay, we're in a fight here?
You are, for sure. And I just can't believe that they're going to deviate from the way they play, and I'm not even sure that they have the option to, given their personnel there. They're just so solid. You know, I really feel like this is a series that's going to go long. You know, they probably have the best D corps in the league there, maybe Carolina, but St. Louis's D is six players deep. They should be able to neutralize some of Vancouver's offense that way, and then hopefully if they could just play that heavy forecheck and wear down guys that aren't big, like Hughes and Tanev and, you know, the Vancouver D, I like their odds of making this a series for sure. I know that's not a concern, but I don't think there's any reason to deviate from the plan yet.
You know, front and center last night for the Vancouver Canucks with a pair of goals is Bo Horvat, and it's a great play on his first goal by Elias Pettersson. to keep the puck hot at the blue line. But Berkey, here's a guy who has very steadily since he was drafted, really, in the New Jersey draft, sort of climbed that ladder. We've watched him every step of the way. And, you know, there's going to come a time where, you know, the Selke Trophy conversation moves away from Couturier and moves away from Bergeron and moves away from O'Reilly and starts to bleed into, you know, Anthony Cirelli, Nico Hischier, and maybe even someone like Bo Horvat. Your thoughts on Horvat last night?
Yeah, he was really good. I mean, they looked to him for a lot more than shutting down the opponent's top line. He's their captain. They looked to him for secondary scoring, and he chipped in big time last night. And I agree. I think as these veteran guys, I think Couturier is going to be in the conversation for 5 or 6 years. Like, he's such a good player. Yep. Cirelli, the same thing. But, yeah, I think Horvat gets in there too, especially as Patrice Bergeron at some point moves on or isn't as effective. But Bo Horvat, one thing he does better than any of those guys is skate. Like, he's a tremendous skater. He's got great power and speed. And so he can make a mistake on the forecheck and still catch people. So that's one element he has that puts him a little notch above some of those other guys.
How hard is it, Justin, to really profoundly change your skating when you get to that pro level? He did not, I assure you, he did not skate like this when he played with the London Knights.
Yeah, I mean, it's super hard. I know that's obvious on its face, but I think of trying to change your grip in golf. Like, if someone says, all right, you got to change the way you hold the golf club, everything else goes out the window, and it's all you can think about. And skating is no different. And I can't remember the exact guy's name, but it was someone who was with Barb Underhill. It was Brian Boyle, who said that one summer that she spent working with him on his skating, he said that he felt like he was so slow because it was easy. Like, this is the summer after working with Barb. He said he just found that it was so much more efficient. He didn't feel like he was working hard on a lot of his shifts. But that can be the case, is that, you know, these skating coaches can iron out inefficiencies in your stride, so you can just preserve that energy and be able to do more of what you usually do over the course of an average shift.
Vancouver wins game one. 5-2 is the final score. They draw first blood. 1-0 Canucks in their best of seven. Yesterday as well, Montreal Canadiens and the Philadelphia Flyers. This was a close one. This one had some heroics by Carey Price. Had a really nice goal by Shea Weber, where he sort of created all the circumstances around it as well. But in the end, Joel Farabee with the game-winning goal a couple of moments right after Shea Weber had tied it up. 2-1 Philadelphia Flyers, Berkey, and they draw first blood here. They are so far, when you factor in the round robin as well, undefeated in the playoffs so far.
Yeah, and I think if you're a Montreal fan, you look at that game and say, well, and their commentary was uniform after the game from the coach and the players, that we demonstrated we can play with these guys. Not for me. I think they're in trouble. And I thought Carey Price continues to be excellent. I don't like the way that series is going to shape up for Montreal one bit. I admire their team. They just don't quit, and their kids are good. But that Flyers team is just relentless.
Thoughts on the Flyers?
Can we talk about how Nick Suzuki almost died?
Oh, geez.
I mean, my
first,
God,
hang on. Full compliment to Nick Suzuki for putting himself. He could have bailed. He could have just said,
"I would have bailed." I assure you,
I'm getting out of here, or I'm going to pancake. And here's your. But no, he sort of just tucked his head and said to himself, "Oh, this is really going to hurt."
Yeah. I mean, Kevin Hayes makes a great pass to drop it into the slot. And then it's like an all-star, hardest shot contest situation for Scott Laughton coming down Broadway. And instead of just, like, pick at a corner, he goes full ceiling-scraping slap shot. Nick Suzuki still stood in there. Carey Price obviously got a piece of it, so Suzuki didn't die. But there was definitely a frame there where my brain thought, oh, this is it. Like, this is where a hockey player dies. So, yes, kudos to Suzuki for doing what it takes in a big moment.
What are you thinking if you're Nick Suzuki? Like, I'm watching this, and
he might have been in too deep, man. He was already there. I don't even know if he could have got out of the way at that point.
But you remember the scene in Pulp Fiction where, you know, where the guy pops out of the bathroom and starts firing his gun at Jules and misses with every single bullet, and, you know, Jules and John Travolta are standing there thinking, okay, this is it. We're going to die now, and all the bullets miss. And they sort of look up and it's like, whoa, what just happened here? How come we're not dead? Like, if you're Nick Suzuki and you see it coming and then all of a sudden you put your head up, are you thinking to yourself, I missed this or am I in heaven? Like, what's going on with Nick Suzuki at that point?
You're the chosen one. You're sent from heaven. You have to believe that you are the one sent to do something greater in this lifetime because you have been spared in that moment.
It's a beautiful save by Carey Price. It's desperation. And Berkey, it's off the tip of his stick. Like, Kelly broke it down yesterday, but man. That
what was it? Carter Hart stopped one with the shaft of his stick, right, last night?
Yeah, yeah.
You know that when I signed the monster, Jonas Gustafsson, he used to practice that.
Really?
So he made a save.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I swear to God. And he made a save one night when it went off the shaft of his stick. And fortunately, or unfortunately, he didn't make as many saves as I would have liked. But he made a save off the shaft of his stick. And I went to him the next day at practice, and I said, well, you got a little bit lucky there. And he said, lucky? He said, I practice it every day. And I watched him do it. Unbelievable to me.
That's remarkable. Do we have any more thoughts on the Flyers-Habs series? I mean, one of the burning issues in this one is, I know he got bumped up later on, but Max Domi starting on the fourth line in the middle. Max Domi starting with Weiss and Belzile. How do we feel about this one? I mean, this looks like, and he's a free agent, albeit restricted at the end of this season. It doesn't look good with Max Domi and the Habs, does it, guys?
No, for my money, I don't know how he got in the doghouse or why, and we'll never know, or maybe because it's a Canadian team, we'll hear 20 theories on it when it's over. But I think if they're going to have a chance in this playoff, even if he's in the doghouse for some reason, they need him to play up in the lineup.
Yeah,
I mean this Flyers team is big, and they work really hard, and they roll four, and they're going to need bodies they can get around that have some truculence.
You know, that's something I've often wondered about coaches is the, they don't like the way a star player is playing. But when you get into these sort of games, it's almost like, yeah, like, okay, you want them to play differently. Now's not the time to teach them a lesson. Like, that's a guy you're going to need going to have any sort of chance. So that seems like a strange choice. But as Berkey mentioned, there's probably reasons for that we won't know. So we'll leave it at that. It is so bizarre, there has to be more to it.
We talked about this on our podcast.
And Jeff, sorry, let me interrupt one second. I used to tell my coach, you can't chain a guy in the doghouse. You got to put him in there on a rope so he can chew his way out. You can't chain him in there. Like, if you're mad at him, you want to sit him out for a game, fine. You want to put him on the fourth line, that's fine. But you can't chain him there. He's got to have a chance to come back. You have no right to have a personal grudge carry over into our team's success. And I thought all my coaches followed that rule pretty well.
Can any of us here, we talked about this on the 31 pod this week, can any of us here see Max Domi next year with the Pittsburgh Penguins?
Well, sure. I mean, Jim Rutherford has made, not afraid to make those sort of moves and made it clear that he wants to make some moves. So I know that Mark Bergevin also seems interested in changing up what their look is. So the matchup makes a lot of sense. Have you heard something there, Jeff, that you're implying that?
The only reason I bring it up is those rumors have been out there going back to when Max was playing with the Arizona Coyotes. We know that family and the Lemieux family are very close. It looks like it's not working out with Max in Montreal. We know that the Pittsburgh Penguins are looking, as you mentioned, Justin, to make some moves, that things have to change. I just wonder if this is the moment that, at the end of this season, if this is the time when Max Domi becomes a Pittsburgh Penguin. Berkey, does that make sense?
I'm not touching that. I used to hate when you guys did this to me. Now it has legs because Jeff Merrick talked about it. No, I'm not touching that.
Putting it out there as a talk radio discussion point. Just three guys throwing it around on a Thursday afternoon. Avalanche and the Coyotes. This one was tight, tight, tight until the Avs blew it open quickly. And front and center was a former Toronto Maple Leaf, Nazem Kadri, who has talked about skating with a chip very much on his shoulder. Berkey.
Well, I mean, I know why they traded Nazem Kadri, and at the time I felt the return on the trade was good for Toronto because Tyson Barrie's a good hockey player. Obviously, it didn't work out here, but and I think Kerfoot's a good player too, so I like the return on it. And I know why they traded Nazem Kadri. His teammates didn't trust him in the playoffs. Two suspensions, 2 years in a row. I get it. But I think Nas is the kind of guy right now that they're dying to have in the lineup. And he gives Colorado a dimension. They've got good bottom six people. He gives them a guy with bite that can chip in. And he scored a very determined goal last night. And he's going to keep doing that. He seems really ready for the playoffs. He's just got to remember not to cross that line.
Borny?
Yeah, that's sort of the argument against moving Nazem Kadri is like, do you think he's going to do it a third time with the suspension thing? But I also understand, and at the time thought it was a good deal too, just because you look like you're in theory solving two problems with that move, and really none of them look to be solved. But yes, Kadri looks excellent with Colorado. That team looks like a juggernaut, and Rick Tocchet sounds not all that pleased and frankly a little concerned with the state of his team, not even just after the loss, but going into this series, it was a lot of, hey, we can't be proud of ourselves for beating Nashville. It's time to refocus. And then obviously the focus didn't look like it was there. So there's some mild panic about how game one went, I would say.
We'll hit a break. Come back. More Hockey Central in a couple of moments. Some games on the horizon, including Columbus and the Tampa Bay Lightning game two. It's scheduled to start at 3 o'clock, guys. Here's the question. Did the Bruins and Canes get underway at 8? We'll talk about that next as Hockey Central continues on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Starting Monday, you can score a 70-inch LG UHD TV from BrentView Electronics. Consider the best seat in the house, or create rather the best seat in the house right at home with this Bluetooth-capable flat screen that has a 4K active HDR, ultra surround sound, and so much more. To enter, collect these secret seats at 7:55, 12:55, and 4:55. Then listen to Tim and Sid to qualify. Listen in on Monday and find the details at sportsnet.ca/590. All right, should we get ready for another long one here? At 3 o'clock, it is Game 2, Columbus Blue Jackets and the Tampa Bay Lightning. What are you looking for, Berkey, in the first game on the docket today?
Well, I think it's really hard to come back from a loss like that. I really do. I think that tears a piece of your heart out. When you work that hard and get that spectacular goaltending and don't get rewarded, and they've really got to bounce back. Now, I think Torts is probably the best coach in the league at getting them focused, mm-hmm. like he did after they blew the lead in game four against Toronto. But I think it's a hard thing to come back from. First things first, let's see if they look shaky out of the gate.
What do you look for this afternoon, Borny?
If you're the less skilled team and you don't have your legs, like how can either team have their legs, but you're the less skilled team without your legs? I think it's going to be real hard for Columbus today, as much as the mental fortitude may be there. I think they're in tough.
All right. Not going to count out John Tortorella, though, or his squad. It is the Bolts. It is the Blue Jackets at 3 o'clock Eastern on Sportsnet. At 5:30, the Blackhawks and the Golden Knights. That one on Sportsnet 360. We'll see if the Hurricanes and Bruins get underway at 8 on CBC and Sportsnet. I say that because the Jackets are on the ice before them with the Tampa Bay Lightning. And then your nightcap game, does Tkachuk and Perry do it again? The Flames and the Stars. Calgary leads this best of 7-1-0. That 10:30 Eastern on CBC and Sportsnet. Smith and Jones, snap.